Today at Reader's Corner, Boise State political science professor John Freemuth, author of Islands Under Siege, National Parks, and the Politics of External Threats.
Essentially, we have systems, a forest system, a park system, the BLM lands, the fish and wildlife refuges, and any of those land management agencies can also have wilderness. Right now, it's still the politics of interests. You know, my energy activity and business versus yours. I think, ironically, you could make a case that even solar and wind have to be looked at as external issues for protected areas. I think it's an interesting question. What is the role of sciences versus democracy in these public land issues?
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our national parks are arguably our nation's greatest treasure, and they have been protected and enjoyed by millions for well over a century. Debates about our parks historically have been around questions of use versus preservation, but these days our parks' greatest challenges come from outside their boundaries. John Freemuth, a senior fellow at the Cecil D. Andrus Center for Public Policy and professor of political science here at Boise State, explores these issues in his award-winning book, Islands Under Siege, National Parks, and the Politics of External Threats. Today we're interviewing Dr. Freemuth on our show as a continuation of sorts to our conversation last week with environmental historian Donald Worster, author of A Passion for Nature, The Life of John Muir. Dr. Freemuth is the author of numerous articles on aspects of environmental policy. He recently was named to an advisory panel of the National Museum of Forest Service History, and he co-edited the book Environmental Politics and Policy in the West. John has been chair of the Science Advisory Board for the Bureau of Land Management. He's also been a high school teacher and a seasonal park ranger. In 2001, John was named the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching Professor of the Year for Idaho. His current book is a book on science, democracy, and public land policy. John joins us in the studio today. John Freemuth, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be here.
So what do you think John Muir would say if he woke up today and here it is, 2011, and these national parks are, first of all, there's more of them than there was when he was around, but more importantly, about these threats that we face. What do you think?
I think he'd be feisty. It would be sort of a different version of the old Hetch Hetchy battle. Now it's, can't we protect these places that we cherish from all this activity outside?
Mm-hmm. John Muir is the founder of the conservation movement, given credit for getting the Sierra Club off the ground as its first executive director. Is the Sierra Club the prominent organization that really defends the national park system?
I don't think so anymore, Bob. They do, but the National Parks and Conservation Association, which was founded and helped by early Park Service directors, people like Robert Sterling Yard, they do parks. And so they're probably, if you want to do park issues, you go to them first. Sierra Club certainly does, but they're all over the place now.
Let's talk about public lands in general. Classify for us how we categorize the public lands, from the parks to the national recreation areas to the wilderness areas, the kind of thing that Congressman Simpson's been working on. Help us understand the difference between and among these definitions and what that means for public policy.
And starting out saying Congress has muddled it up tremendously and they can do whatever they want. But essentially we have systems, a forest system, a park system, the BLM lands, the fish and wildlife refuges. But we also have within that things like wilderness. And any of those land management agencies can also have wilderness. But that's the easiest way to think about it.
Now, the national park system itself, it oversees all the national parks in America?
Yes. The thing that might confuse Americans is there are national monuments now that they don't administer. The Forest Service has one and the BLM has a number. And the national recreation areas, both the Forest Service and BLM administer. So that, Forest Service and Park Service, that can be confusing to people.
So when it comes to the national parks, and out this way we think of Glacier, we think of Yellowstone, are two of the closest to us here in Boise. Those are in number nationwide, what, 58?
About 58 or 59, where there's 380-plus units of the park system, which are things besides parks.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that of those 58, when I looked at the national map of national parks, only seven are east of the Mississippi.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a Western phenomenon.
It really is a Western phenomenon, and it has a lot to do with the exploration and settlement of the West and the discovery of these places.
Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that the parks are located in the West, at least 51 of them or so, is there any legal or constitutional claim that Western states have over these parks that other states outside the West do not? And I ask that question because oftentimes you hear governors talk very as though they own them, as though these national parks are their babies.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just curious, these are national parks.
Yes,
and
they are.
Why should Western states have any more to say about them than other states?
I think there's two ways to look at that. One is certainly they're valuable economically. So governors would want parks managed in that economic sense to help the local communities bring in tourist dollars. But they're federal lands. And so they're federally managed by the National Park Service, not by the states.
Mm-hmm. So in your book, you talk about the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. Mm-hmm. Help us distinguish a national recreation area from a national park. And I think it has something to do, as a matter of fact, with the point you're trying to make, one of the points you're trying to make in your book.
Well, yeah, it's complicated because there are urban national recreation areas. Listeners that probably San Francisco's close, the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is urban. Mm-hmm. The Forest Service has two of them in Idaho, the Sawtooth National Recreation Area and Hell's Canyon. And that's just because Congress did what Congress did, probably because of hunting issues. Glen Canyon is around a lake, Lake Powell, and that's one of the reasons that they didn't make it a national park. And it also mandates both grazing and mining within the unit. So mm-hmm. many national parks don't have grazing and mining, but recreation areas can often.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does the Sawtooth National Recreation Area affect what Congressman Simpson is trying to do with the Boulder White Clouds, which I think he wants to create a wilderness designation there?
Well, that's
same area.
Well, yes, essentially. Ironically, there was actually a Park Service proposal in the 60s that would have made a large park on both sides of the Sawtooth Valley with also wilderness areas. So it's always been talked about as sort of the other half of protecting the Sawtooths, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you believe any of these designated wilderness areas will be made state or national parks as we go into the future?
You know, anymore, if another agency is managing it as wilderness, the answer to me would be no. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to do that if they're sort of taking care of it as wilderness.
Mm-hmm. So the challenge these days seems to be that more and more people are visiting these parks.
Well, you know, I think so. Though then Secretary Kempthorne and the Park Service got concerned that we weren't. And now the visitation's back up again. I think the bigger issue, Bob, is Oprah went to Yosemite this summer and I say rightly so, national parks are still visited by upper middle class, primarily white people. And we really don't speak to black Americans about our Western national parks. That used to bug me as a ranger. But I think she jumped on that, took Winnebago to Yosemite, and the whole thing was a hoot to try to say, you know, she said, I've never gone there, and I'm going to go. And so that's the big conversation. Now, I think people are still going. Probably the economy's driving this. Mm-hmm. They're staying home more.
You know, I went down to a meeting in Vegas a few weeks ago and took in a show of Garth Brooks.
Oh, yeah?
And at the end of the show, he was talking about, he asked the audience to give him some questions. Mm-hmm. What would you like to know about me? And somewhere in the conversation, some Montanan mentioned Glacier National Park. And Garth looked at him with a blank stare.
Wow.
Had no idea there was such a place called Glacier National Park. And it's the first time I realized that these Western parks that are so familiar to us aren't very well known.
Including to the Eastern media at times. I've had conversations with them, and when they've confused the Forest Service with the Park Service.
Yeah.
So it's not just Garth Brooks. It's more common.
And that really gets us to one of the points I think you're trying to make in your book. You talk about this issue of visibility impairment, and I want to discuss mm-hmm. that later, but you talk about the tar sands issue,
mm-hmm.
the fact that there are some very valuable things under these national properties,
yes.
whether it's a park or a wilderness area, whatever it is, and we are taking those out.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, some of the parks themselves are threatened in various ways.
Yeah.
Well, if people don't even know about the parks, And maybe this is why it's a good thing Oprah went down there to Yosemite and advertised coming to the parks. Then how could you ever expect there to be a balance of interest instead of the kind of interest you and I know about, right, where all the oil and gas guys get lobbyists, go to the appropriate legislative body and get done what they need to get done, and the people who are visiting in the summer are back home not knowing a thing about it.
Well, there I think what you're going to find is these groups you asked me about at the beginning are going to take up the banner on that, the National Parks and Conservation Association, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, and they will bring it to the attention of relevant folks. Yeah, most Americans probably couldn't tell you where Canyonlands National Park is.
So let's talk about some of these external threats that you discuss in your book. Islands of Siege, what a great metaphor for a national park. You're obviously referring to the fact that they're under siege from the outside. What are those threats today? I mentioned just the tar sands, but there's a lot more than that.
There are a lot, and that was actually suggested to me by Roderick Nash, who's a noted environmental historian like Don Wooster is and others. But it's essentially the notion, I think primarily it would be pollution, like air pollution. A lot of time adjacent activities, whether it be mining or the logging that might impact the watershed, even more and more people moving in next to the park can be an issue. And so it's stuff that the National Park Service can't control because it doesn't have the legal authority to.
When did these issues really start to emerge as a serious problem?
Probably in the 70s. Yeah. Both the Park Service and NPCA issued papers on the growing external threats problem to the national park. So I'd say, and that really corresponds with sort of the environmental movement of that era. We start worrying about air pollution, water pollution, waste, activities, things like that. So that'd be my thought.
I've been reading a lot lately about how the natural gas folks are moving closer and closer to the Jackson Hole area, Yellowstone, Grand Teton. Mm-hmm. And as they do that, of course, they're going to be in this category of people who are threatening these national lands. So the question is, has anybody ever studied the extent to which what we're doing to the ground in or near these national parks, let's just say near, I don't think we're doing it in them, but as we talk about this Jackson Hole area, the extent to which it's worth the investment up against the incredible amount of investments that are going on in alternative energy, wind and solar comes to mind. Across the West, every state is investing very seriously, not just the states, but the federal government, the private sector, across Boise right now. There's all kinds of new little firms sprouting up that are about solar, that are about wind. Well, that's a lot of energy that's going to be produced down the road.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if anybody's doing that old cost-benefit analysis to examine whether it's worth tearing up western Wyoming for natural gas when, in fact, in a few years, we're going to have access to all kinds of new forms of energy.
Well, certainly advocates are, and certainly, the University of Wyoming, because of all their energy money, has created a huge energy institute to look at this sort of business. But right now, it's still the politics of interests. You know, my energy activity and business versus yours. And so we're all kind of lobbying for what we want, though I think, ironically, you could make a case that even solar and wind have to be looked at as external issues for protected areas. I mean, are people going to like a vista covered with wind turbines? Right. I have no idea.
Right. Well, let's talk about the vistas. Visibility impairment. I must admit, until I read your book, I never really understood that was an issue, that somebody had placed that up there on the policy block, the policy agenda, and said, we have to deal with it. And I will also say that as somebody who's visited some of these parks, I've noticed that the views aren't so hot too many days in the summertime. Yeah. So tell us, first of all, how this issue of visibility impairment arose and where it stands now in the overall scheme of things, as you covered it in your book.
It arose in the 70s from former park seasonals like me, who took a lot of pictures, started noticing stuff from Bryce Canyon and Grand Canyon and comparing pictures. They added it to the 77 Clean Air Act amendments. Wasn't very controversial, and it was only a tiny portion of that law, because that law is primarily about our health. It's not about visibility. They were able to finally, in 20 years, nail one of the power plants in Page, Arizona, the Navajo Generating Station, because they could show it was impairing the air quality in Grand Canyon. The idea of going after regional haze, which is a lot more complicated issue, still hasn't been resolved, and we've now gone from 1977 to 2010. Very complex issue in modeling and politics. The air quality some places is better, but not the regional haze issues made it worse, on the other hand. So it really depends.
Now, tell us alongside that story, the Montana story. About the drilling next to or near the Glacier National Park?
Yeah, Glacier, Bob Kiter, who's a friend of mine, he's a law professor, a Stegner professor at UU, University of Utah. He and some other people, Joe Sachs, kind of studied and looked and thought that Glacier was maybe one of the most impacted units of the park system. And that one is because primarily of all sort of adjacent mining activities and things like that. Maybe even climate change, ironically. Whether it is or not, it's questionable, but probably most of the Western parks, because of the West and its energy resources, are going to have external mining issues to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the visibility impairment also an issue for some place like Glacier?
Not as much, because there aren't sources up around Glacier like there are in the American Southwest, and there's not a large urban area near it. So probably not as much, no.
I know when I lived in the Southeast, Smoky Mountain National Park was really impacted, and they identified some power plants, I think, in northern Georgia in some areas where it was just coming right up off the
coast. Yeah. In fact, here's an iconic story for your listeners. Shenandoah is another one, and the benchmark for Shenandoah visibility used to be you could see the Washington Monument on a clear day. No way you can now. You're very familiar with that area, but that's sort of right. Your iconic story about an Eastern Park's visibility impairment.
You're listening to John Freemuth. He's the author of Islands Under Siege, and he is a political science professor at Boise State University. You talk about in your book the Colorado Plateau, Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. We've been discussing it. What is the energy value in that area to America and beyond?
Well, it's pretty loaded with either tar sands, what the Canadians call oil sands, that maybe some of your listeners are pretty familiar with. There is some coal shale, oil shale stuff all around and through that area up into Colorado. The limiting factor there, besides a lot of the protected areas, the parks and so forth, is water. If you're going to develop that stuff, nobody's figured out the water needs, and that area is dry, and a lot of that water's spoken for already.
Now, when I think of tar sands, I think of those photos I've pulled down off the web of Canada's tar sands, which has to be one of the ugliest landscapes in or across the planet.
Yeah.
Is that what's going on in Utah?
Not yet. And it looks like the areas they're talking about aren't as close now to Canyonlands, the BLM Wilderness and Glen Canyon. There's a whole BLM effort to redo this again a little bit north. But that's the big issue, is how would you get it out of there, and what would be the impact on air and water quality to do it? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff there. That's the great issue.
Help us understand what we're doing in the tar sands process. What's going on there?
What they will do, and the technology, they're still working on improving it, they essentially have to inject down into the ground to get the oil to flow. It's sort of oil impregnated sandstone. And so they would have to put water, at least the last of the processes I'm familiar with, to heat it up to get it out. And that's a lot of water. And then it has an air impact when you do it. And so, and it's areas that are fairly remote and relatively pristine.
So eventually this will force a choice between the environment and the economy, is it safe to say?
Well, it's going to, as we watch issues that affect this, like the Middle East and things going on in Egypt and the price of oil going up, you can just watch the politics go up and down based on energy politics around it.
I guess it takes me back to the issue of what role people who are visitors can play in the policy process. You mentioned earlier some associations like the Sierra Club and others that will get involved, but today when you look at the policy process, is it really a fair and balanced process when it comes to who's at the table, who gets to influence the decision making?
That's a really good question. I don't think we're to the day of reckoning yet. I mean, right now it's more hypothetical stuff going on, and you've already nailed it. Where are we going with energy? Are we going to do a lot more of this? What about renewables? And so there's a sort of an unsettled feeling that we're about to have these big battles. Wyoming, though, has been fairly progressive, not just about parks, but about looking. We've got a very big issue in the West about the sage grouse that's pending, trying to set aside oil and gas areas that are prime sage grouse habitat to protect them. And so right now, I think generally the parks remain iconic enough to Americans that all you have to say is a national park is threatened, and people will begin to think that's not necessarily something that they want to see happening unless it's inevitable.
Well, speaking of the sage grouse, that does remind me that you can't just lump all the folks who might be concerned about the preservation of our national parks into the category of environmentalists. Oh, no. There's also the what I guess I would call the conservationists, the outdoorsmen, the folks, Ducks Unlimited, whatever the organization is. Do you see an increasing number? I mean, when you mention sage grouse, I would think that hunters are going to start getting nervous. In fact, I think in western Colorado, there's some ranchers, some very conservative ranchers, who decided to take on the natural gas drilling, I believe it was.
You get all kinds of weird cleavages on that, as we'd say, as political scientists. Yeah. But yeah, hunters don't really fight for parks because most Western parks don't allow hunting, but they fight for habitat. So they're going to get worried about encroaching development that hurts the habitat of the critters they like to hunt.
Right.
We also have one more issue. You take the sage grouse, all right, and it actually, some of its habitat is right where people would like to put solar and wind. So you got two public goods contending with one another. Are the sage grouse more important than green energy? That can be a tough one, too. Mm-hmm.
So the folks who are actually managing these parks, the park ranger, tell us a little bit about, and I'm talking not just about the park ranger who's on duty keeping an eye on things on any given summer day in Yellowstone, but the park rangers who have moved up into policymaking positions are going to play a key role in advising Congress or advising the Secretary of the Interior or whoever they report to. Tell us about how they get educated. Where are they from? What kind of a culture do they come from when it comes to their background and their training and their skills?
I think over the last 10 or 15 years, the Park Service has done a phenomenal job at professionalizing the agency with a lot more science and resource management background. You might even get him on your show sometime because he's a friend of mine. But the director of the Park Service, John Jarvis, is the first trained biologist to ever run the Park Service. Was a resource management specialist and worked his way up the system because he's just a very good manager. But generally, I think you're going to find those people with college degrees in a natural resource or human resource science now, master's perhaps.
Which sounds like a very good thing for the challenges.
I think it is. And then the other skill they have to have is they have to work with their communities around the park well, because so many people have interests.
Right. Now, once upon a time, you did this.
I did
this on a seasonal basis.
Tell us
about your experience.
Oh, great job. I almost thought about the whole thing as a career, but I was a ranger at both Lee's Ferry, which is where the river trips put into Grand Canyon, and up at Waweep, which is near Page, Arizona, and I got to do just about everything. It's a great job to just meet visitors and talk about things, and yeah, I wouldn't trade those summers for anything.
Yeah. And you did some academic publications that were related to your work with the Park Service. One of them was about Everett Roos. Is that his name?
Yeah, that's kind of a fun story that it's hard to tell quickly, but he's this romantic character that disappeared in the Escalante Drainage, which is sort of part of the park or the rec area. And it's just this romantic story about a kid who went out and explored the area and then just disappeared, and nobody ever knew what happened.
How old was he?
He was in his early 20s.
And this was when?
This was in the 30s. And people claimed they'd kept seeing him. He left these weird, mysterious carvings in the rock that said Nemo, which means no one. Then somebody thought they'd found some bones across the Colorado River. Turned out not to be his. But the neatest thing to me is I got a letter from his brother when I was a ranger saying, I really liked your piece. And it was a park handout, really, more than anything else. And it got visitors interested in just going out into that part of the Escalante to see what I was talking about. And I'm a sucker for stuff like that. It was fun.
But he's never been found at this
day.
Never
been found. You know, he could still be alive, probably not, but literally he disappeared and nothing was ever found except his burrows. They brought in native trackers. They couldn't figure it out. And back then, that country was really inaccessible country.
So what's your new book?
Well, I've gotten real interested because of my work with USGS and some friends there.
The Geological Survey.
Yeah, they've got some fantastic scientists here that, in fact, have done a great book on the sage grouse, Steve Connick, who's a biologist with them. And I wrote the introduction to their book on the role of science and policy, and I've given a lot of talks. And I think it's an interesting question. What is the role of sciences versus the public or democracy in these public land issues? And I know a lot of scientists that I have a lot of respect for, so I'm kind of fired up about it. Trying to get an NSF grant, too.
For a long time, there's been this discussion of the extent to which the presidency relies enough on scientific evidence. And during the Bush administration, there was a lot of controversy over this, and there have been in past administrations before that. What's your take on how well the Obama administration is doing when it comes to inserting solid academic and scientific experts where they need to be in the administration to advise and consult as opposed to how it's been done in the past?
I think they're trying to do the right thing. We're all watching right now. Ken Salazar, Secretary of Interior, just issued a ruling that they want to hire a scientific integrity officer to manage the science process in Interior. And we're all like, well, how's that going to work?
I was going to say, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
We don't know, but it's an interesting concept, to say the least.
Well, when it comes to Salazar as the Secretary of the Interior, he certainly was met out west with, oh, well, that's interesting.
Yes.
You chose a Westerner. He was a Democrat or is a Democrat, obviously, given the fact that the president made the appointment. What kind of reviews is Salazar playing to these days?
Well, I think, you know, it's ideological. I think he's doing a pretty good job. They made great appointments for the agency directors in Interior. He's a Western rancher himself from Colorado. And so I think he's doing a pretty good job by and large, you know, but some people are not going to like what the Secretary of Interior does. That's just the politics of it.
Well, let's go back to where we started, the national park system. These 57 parks that are across the West, obviously they vary in terms of accessibility. Yosemite is to the point where I think they're literally regulating the numbers of people that go in. They're bringing them in buses and things to eliminate the traffic. Is that the future of the national park? We can expect more of this given the volume.
For some of them that are so close to large urban areas like Yosemite is. And the ones that are magnets, like perhaps Yellowstone, others don't have that pressure. And, of course, the thing for the Park Service is they want people to come, so they support it, but they don't want the experience ruined. So Yosemite's probably the model in some ways because of how many people live within 4 hours of that park. And you can just watch how the Park Service has changed its management of Yosemite as its own values have changed.
I've backpacked the least visited park in the United States, Isle Royale National Park in Lake Superior.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because you don't see a lot of people.
No.
You may see more wolves and moose than you see people because it's so doggone hard to get to. You have to take a boat across the Superior to get into the place. But it shows you the opposite end of the spectrum to the busier park in Yosemite. Then there's Glacier, which, of course, people are concerned about as a bellwether of climate change.
Yeah, that's true. And here's a real tough issue. If there's climate change, regardless of whether we're causing it or it's a natural change, the Park Service, are they supposed to now intervene to try to keep their iconic resources? Think of the giant sequoia. If things are warming, are they going to have to water the sequoia so they don't start to die? That means they're going to have to intervene in nature because we're probably going to ask them to. We don't want to lose these trees. Now, glaciers might be a little harder to intervene on, but it's new issues for them.
Well, John Freemuth, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for the book, Islands Under Siege. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week at Reader's Corner as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world.